You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. Since September 11, 2001, the United States has been engaged in nonstop conflict abroad.
The first strike against terrorism as a missile barrage lands on Afghanistan.
This hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
For President Obama, it's the War on Terrorism 2.0. Mr. Obama warned this new fight won't be over soon.
For the last two decades, American diplomacy has been defined by our wars and U.S. attempts at nation-building in Afghanistan and Iraq, and a so-called global war on terror that has sent U.S. troops and guns to a long list of nations in the Middle East, Asia, and Africa.
Attacks on U.S. and European military targets in Somalia. The terror group al-Shabaab is claiming responsibility.
Very serious questions up on Capitol Hill about U.S. weapons in Yemen falling into enemy hands.
The U.S. military is being accused of killing dozens of civilians, including women and children, during a 2019 airstrike in Syria.
Yemen, Syria, Pakistan, Somalia, places most American citizens only recognize from occasional news headlines. We've heard stories about the U.S. use of drones and about chemical warfare and ethnic cleansing abroad, on battlefields and targeting civilians. But because these conflicts have dragged on for so long and are oceans away, it's harder and harder to process the true human costs of war. And if the American people and the nation's military can't see the full scope, the reality of war, how can we hold ourselves accountable to not only international standards, but to the families and individuals caught in the line of fire? New York Times journalist Azmat Khan says it doesn't have to be that way. She won a Pulitzer in 2019 for uncovering the U.S. military's failure to adequately investigate civilian casualties from remote warfare, particularly in the ongoing wars against the Islamic State, or IS. She says making this information publicly accessible doesn't just save lives today. It could empower average Americans to have a greater say and a stake in our military's actions at home and abroad. Azmat Khan, welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you so much for having me, Ray.
This new kind of warfare was presented to the public as clean, almost surgical. Instead of banging down doors and engaging in house-to-house fighting, Americans could identify targets and attack them with lower risk to U.S. personnel and take bad actors like Islamic State fighters off the battlefield. That's the theory. Did it work in practice?
Not to the extent that was claimed. In fact, there is a really wide gap between what we have been told for years behind these precision airstrikes and the reality on the ground. Now, for years, we've been told that it's not just minimal loss to American life, but it's minimal loss to foreigners, to others, when we're conducting these kinds of combat operations. And the United States has for years claimed not just to do this with precision, but that when mistakes happen, that they investigate, that they look into them. So much so that when the war against ISIS began, Barack Obama, president at the time, was quite clear in saying that we have this model for global accountability and that when something happens, we are leading when it comes to determining what went wrong and why. And with respect to that, I found an incredible gap. You know, I found that the United States, almost entirely, with very few exceptions, rarely investigated what went wrong and why when it had civilian casualties. I found that the civilian death rate, when I did a ground sample and compared it to these admitted casualties that the United States has been putting out for years, that the true rate of civilian death of the sample that I did on the ground was not one or two or three times higher. It was 31 times higher than what our government claimed. And so you might think that with this model of accountability, even if this rate is much higher, that when we're able to determine that something went wrong, that we would investigate why and try to learn lessons from it. that really hasn't been happening. So I obtained more than 1,300 of the military's own assessments, these so-called investigations that they claim to have been doing, and found not a single instance of a finding of wrongdoing or disciplinary action. Very, very few lessons learned, and it almost seemed to many of those that I spoke with that these kinds of assessments, this model of accountability, which the public has not had access to, didn't really function as a means of accountability so much as it served as legal cover or cover for expanding and legitimizing the use of these kinds of combat operations.
If part of the intent is to keep Americans off the battlefield, is there any way to do reliable after-action reports anyway? If you're going to do them, don't Americans, or American resources of some sort, have to end up going into hostile areas anyway?
So look, I'm just a journalist, right? I don't have any of the protections of the U.S. military, but I was able to go and do this work, right? I was able to negotiate access to areas that are very hard to get access to, but the military would have no problems negotiating that kind of access. I was going also after hostilities had primarily concluded. I was getting to these places, and I did it at great difficulty. It would be much easier for the military to do the work that I was doing, and yet they didn't do it. In only one case, of the documents that I had, of these 1,300 allegations, in only one case did they journey to the site of an incident and investigate. And even that was only because it had really attracted just widespread media attention. And the report they came out with was one that very much didn't really find fault of their own. It is troubling to me that this kind of excuse, this idea that this would create expanded risk to investigate after the fact. Sure, it is true that deploying troops to the ground in real time would put American troops at risk. But given my own experiences traveling to these places and doing this work as a mere journalist, I know that it is simply incorrect to claim that that same risk comes from investigating. In fact, I think there's a real argument to be made that perhaps they don't want to know what this casualty rate actually is, and they don't actually really want to improve what's going wrong.
Is the problem here really civilian casualties, or is it the mismatch between the assumptions that lead to these policies not matching the reality? Well, I mean, civilians die in war. Civilians die massively in war as the munitions that we use to fight war become more lethal over time. Is the problem the assurances that don't match the reality, or that civilians are dying at all?
I think no matter where you come from, when you look at this issue, the very first problem here really is that Americans are being sold a myth about warfare, right? Americans have a right to know what the true costs of war are in order to make informed decisions, you know, the basis for any democratic society. You need to know what those costs actually are. Now, I'm not saying that the U.S. military has concluded a very different number and they're now suppressing that number from the public. I'm saying that they have gone out of their way to put out these numbers that they should know are vastly incorrect. They've put out what is essentially a myth, and Americans are making determinations about war on that basis. It's really receded from the public spotlight. We don't talk about it with that kind of recognition or understanding of the costs of war. This deeper question, a moral question you're asking about casualties, it is true that there are casualties. It is true that repeatedly governments have sought to sell a narrative of precise war, of this kind of clean war, and that has always been false. But I think the problem is also just that they're claiming to have a model of accountability in so many ways that this is legitimizing and expanding the use of these operations. And it also adds that kind of element of, you know, what kinds of effects are these happening on the ground? And I would be remiss if I didn't talk about Afghanistan right now, which was also a part of my ground reporting. But what I found when I was on the ground investigating airstrikes was that the role of civilian casualties played an enormous, enormous role in why we lost that war. That is undeniable. And on a strategic military thinking basis, it is very hard to justify that the military's inability to not just chronicle and understand how many civilian casualties were happening, but its almost willful ignorance of the effect those casualties were having on the ground is just incredibly reckless. Now, on another basis about whether or not we want to accept those casualties, Americans need to have a conversation about that. And they simply are not able to do that with this absence of information.
When you tried to find out if the U.S. was killing civilians in greater or smaller numbers, was the Department of Defense forthcoming? Would they tell you what you were trying to find out? Are they required to make these casualties, what they eventually come to understand about the aftermath of these strikes, available to Congress, available to the public? What are the obligations here?
So there should be an obligation to make that public. That was the argument I made, that my lawyers made, but I actually had to sue the U.S. Department of Defense and U.S. Central Command in order to obtain these records. We're talking about more than 5,400 pages. Of these 1,300 documents, only less than a dozen had ever been made public, if I'm remembering correctly. These were suppressed from the public. We didn't get a chance to see it. And not only that, they may owe that to the public, but I found myself constantly at odds with them. Now, I do want to say that there have been some public affair officers, and there have been so many military sources I've had who've worked with me and who have been candid and have really cared about that accountability and wanted to see it. This is not, you know, it's a reflective of a system that we're seeing, not of the people necessarily involved in it, because I've met so many people who truly want to see and understand what the costs of war actually are. And in fact, I know there are even people who would defend this system quite aggressively, who've also been really encouraging of my work because they benefit from knowing the military is not going on the ground. They really want to know what I'm seeing, hearing, and finding.
You know, during the era of the all-volunteer military and the post-Cold War gradual reduction to those people in uniform being a very small portion of the population overall, the military has tried to institute a kind of mystique about a warrior culture, a warrior caste that's almost separate from the rest of us mere civilians. And they sometimes use that as a cover for not telling you the answers to fairly straightforward questions, because it's dismissed as, you don't understand, we're a different kind of people doing a different kind of thing, and we could tell you that, but you wouldn't understand the answer. Do people who have to make war against the Islamic State tell you honestly about the difference between remote and conventional warfare? Can you even get that interview with the policymakers, not just the people sitting with the joysticks at the screens, but the people who decide this is how we're going to go after this objective, and this is why?
I don't see that level of candidness you're talking about from the very top. I simply don't. I hear it so much from people who are having to push these buttons, the people who are analyzing the imagery on these feeds and having to look at these gruesome images. I hear that kind of candidness from them, and yet we're not hearing it from the very top. It's an incisive question, because I've talked to so many policymakers, especially those who are in Congress, especially those who have worked in different White Houses. And what I've been told is that when they have tried to propose changes, or when they've tried to even have these kinds of more realistic conversations about them, they are treated like they simply do not understand, that they are outsiders, that how dare you kind of put these people at risk. It's framed, you know, that kind of security argument often comes into the conversation, but it's also treated as, this is not your realm of expertise, don't you dare try to touch it. So after I published these documents and we put them out on the New York Times, you can go through them yourself, you know, these thousands of pages of records, I was speaking to somebody who, you know, I have many sources within different aspects of oversight in Congress, somebody involved in congressional oversight at the institution most poised to take any kind of oversight action. And he said to me, wow, we're going through these and we've never seen these before. We actually have never had access to these. And it just floored me that me, lowly journalist, right, had been able to, you know, I did have to sue to get them, but that this was something that a really important congressional oversight body did not have, and that they were not able to stipulate these releases. I know that there have been congressional officials who've several times now tried to pass legislation that would make these kinds of records automatically become public. They would be redacted and filtered in the same way that perhaps I got them, but they would become part of a database that the public could access and that Congress would have access to. That is not even the case. You know, if you're asking about cherished values such as oversight, civilian oversight of the military, I mean, that blew me away. They don't even have access to these records, let alone the classified intelligence that often underpins these. And that's been a big part of my reporting, is that so often when you go on the ground and you investigate something and you come back with your findings, these people were civilians, this was not that target, you're often met with the response of, well, we have access to classified intelligence that you don't. This has always been an argument, but it really, really grew after 9/11. And yet, we never get to see the transparency behind that. That's really why I mounted a years-long effort to get these records, because they do detail in redacted form some of what went behind these. But that full answer, what you would really need to make real conclusions about how these wars are going, the American public simply does not have.
What was the effect of these attacks gone wrong on the civilian populations? The Islamic State was a nasty bit of business. Brutal, lethal governance in the areas it conquered, mass executions, rapes, widespread killing of civilians. But did civilians look upon U.S. efforts as the inevitable mistakes of people trying to help them, or just a different bunch of people who end up hurting and killing them, just like the people they're trying to defeat on the battlefield?
In Afghanistan, I can say with confidence, particularly in the south and these areas that where there was an enormous Taliban resurgence, that it played a very serious role. Now, in Iraq and Syria, it is more complex. I primarily found that it played a role in mass casualty incidents where a large number of a community was wiped out in these air attacks. You would see shifts in local populations. But I will say that the real effect is not so much about the United States, so much as it is about local attitudes towards their own government, right? So local attitudes, for example, in Mosul towards the central government of Iraq, that certainly played a role. I heard again and again from people that we paid the price for eliminating ISIS, and we paid it with our bodies. We had to be this cost, and they're quite bitter about it, right? You've seen the destruction of entire cities that are now in shambles. If you look at Raqqa, if you look at Mosul, these are cities that are in shambles, and there's a lot of resentment towards their own government that, you know, I hear a lot of what some would describe as conspiracy theories from people of, like, they wanted us to be destroyed. They've never liked us. And you hear sometimes, like, sectarian influences and their sort of framing of that. But now you might think, like, why does this matter for us ordinary Americans, that people might have these doubts about their government or these kinds of resentments? Well, those are the circumstances that actually gave rise to ISIS. ISIS was able to grow in the region because there was such incredible discontent among the local populations. There were these protests, and ISIS was able to exploit those kinds of grievances to its own advantage. And it does matter for Americans on that level, certainly.
The United States has often paid compensation to families. Does that make these unintentional casualties easier to trace? Is there a requirement that a person like you or me can find out what the United States has been spending money on in these compensation payments?
They don't make those payments anymore. Now, we used to make them in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in the aughts. But in my reporting, I have found very, very few examples of payments in Iraq or Syria. They're mandated in recent years to sort of report to Congress how many payments they've made. And I went out of my way to put in these requests and sue as well for those payment records. And I was blown away. So, for example, you know, they claim these 6 payments in Iraq were made for civilian casualties. I finally got my hands on the record, and first of all, 3 of them were for Iraq and 3 were for Syria. And when I dug into what they were for, they were actually not for civilian casualties incurred. They were payments made to partner forces as families when those partner forces were lost. And so they're publicly claiming to Congress, it's really troubling, they're publicly claiming to Congress, you know, we've made so-and-so payments in these years for civilian casualties where ostensibly we're mitigating those effects. There are very few made. And the very first payment offer in the war against ISIS was made to somebody whom I had been reporting on and had sort of brought forth this case, and it was the result of my reporting that they made this payment offer. And do you know how much it was? For the loss of 4 of his family members, 2 of his homes, you know, they will not call it compensation, they'll call it condolence, a gesture of sympathy and gratitude. He was offered $15,000. $15,000. And so he turned it down. And so we're not even making these payments. When they are made, they're incredibly low. They can be incredibly arbitrary. Usually, the cost for a death is capped at $2,500. And so the idea even that, oh, maybe we're making these payments, maybe we're making changes on the ground, or even that we could use these payments to track these effects, unfortunately, is far-fetched.
So many of the people who have lived in that part of the world for countless generations were already under tremendous stress, moving, trying to stay one step ahead of the fighting, trying to stay out of the way of opposing forces, and they end up getting killed in this crazy, freaky way. It was heartbreaking to read some of the individual stories of people who were trying to keep in contact with extended families, trying to look after cousins and uncles and parents, and having everybody end up in rubble. What did they have to say about the United States when it was over?
You know, this is the hardest part of the job, is speaking to people who they've endured the worst kinds of tragedies you can imagine, right? And for some families, it happened multiple times, right? There would be one airstrike in 2016 and then another in 2017, and entire families have been wiped out. You know, I know a young woman, her name is Karima. She was the only person who survived in the house that she was in, and 33 of her family members died. She barely made it out. And she lives with that every single day. And she has yet to receive an apology. The U.S. has admitted 13 casualties in that incident, and she and her family have documented more than 33. I've been to the site of this airstrike. I've spoken to her. Others have as well. She met an American in the hours after this happened. His name is Patrick Osgood, and he tried very hard to report this to the military, and yet nothing came of that. So there is a real resentment, not just of the fact that these occurred, but that when efforts were made to be heard, to get an apology, to receive some kind of acknowledgement of their losses, so as not to be tallied among ISIS, so as not to be perceived in this way that is they are the enemy, people who have often, they suffered incredible brutality at the hands of ISIS, but then to be labeled that is extremely offensive. What people will describe depends on what country you're in. I will say that America's reputation in Iraq, that was long gone. But in certain places, depending on where you are, in parts of Syria, you know, it does have a very real effect on America's place in the world.
As we got deeper into this era of remote warfare, various protocols evolved to try to spread accountability, to increase reliability. Multiple sets of eyes on the same images, authorizations from higher ups, whether to move ahead with an attack. Has this achieved some of the desired effects, either raising the accuracy of what's being struck or removing some of that sense of moral injury by changing the level of accountability on any one actor in the chain?
So I've talked to some officials who are involved in this work who've said, look, it makes us feel a little better psychologically to know that we've gone through this process, that we've filled out these assessments. And there's a psychological reason for those assessments. But at the same time, for so many of these kinds of procedural changes that have been made, that I'm not seeing that actually necessarily materialize. Like I said, there were very few lessons learned, very few efforts to implement changes based on what they were finding. These assessments were not used. They were not studied in aggregate. Like, I was really the first to study these in aggregate and with that level of detail. It is troubling because we are being told we are a model for accountability, and yet the reality is very different.
Are there things that anybody told you we could be doing, we should be doing, to raise the effectiveness and accuracy of these strikes, to take out some of the problems that you found in your reporting?
Yes, many. So something so simple as a change in even the layout of these assessments, in which you would check a single box that would maybe describe mitigating factors or factors that were involved in that strike happening, would allow people to study these in aggregate more easily. Even the assessment system is not set up in a way that allows you to easily discern a cause of what went wrong and then to later on to be able to calculate it. So something that simple is something that's been encouraged and is just really startling, that even that level of understanding we do not have, that kinds of means of aggregating this. Others talk, actually, they make an argument, and I saw this in some of the documents, that sometimes these casualties were the result of not having a wide enough frame of view to be able to calculate who might enter it. And the inclusion of more surveillance aircraft would have prevented those casualties. You know, that played a role. There are so many different, you know, I really describe what I do see in the reporting as these gestures, and I can't help but ask myself, if these are so straightforward, if they are so obvious, so for example, something as simple as a means to identify root causes and then to tabulate it later, if we're not doing that, what are these for? Do we ever really want to do that? Is that not a real part of the mission? You have to ask.
Well, is it at long last a question really of American needs and desires? Not really serving the interests of people on the ground, but more an effort to simply reduce U.S. deaths and injuries that come from inserting forces into these territories and sending them to fight on the ground. Is this about our needs, not their needs?
Well, of course it's about our needs, but here's the thing. You can reduce those costs to Americans and employ these tactics and these weapons and just be honest that civilians are dying, but not necessarily make these claims about a system of accountability to say that we look at every single one, we investigate them deeply, and when mistakes happen, we learn lessons. That is added to it, right? So certainly we can reduce costs to American lives, but why at the same time sell these myths about clean warfare? It really calls into question that this goes far beyond just American lives.
Well, your sourcing was detailed and disturbing. Your findings were formidable. Will this change anything? Is this a kind of sobering moment over at the Pentagon where, instead of merely being an irritant, or something, if you hunker down, you can wait till it blows over? Or might this have an effect on the way we make war in these parts of the world?
It's a tough question to answer. And I should just say at the outset, the military itself, the Pentagon from the very top, have made comments and have taken action that would make it appear that this is something they're really committed to. After the Pulitzer Prize was awarded, the spokesperson for the Pentagon came forward to say that this was valuable reporting, that it taught hard lessons, that it was hard to hear but important, and an example of the value of the free press. The Secretary of Defense, after a series of these kinds of investigations, he put forth this memo stipulating that this long-awaited civilian casualty policy that had been required years ago be implemented by a particular date, be actually submitted to him by a particular date. And that has given a lot of promise because it's coming from the very top to many who are military observers. And yet I think my own work on this, when I've looked at sort of the history of accountability and when it has come about and when transformative change has taken place, it was often the result of the American public feeling incredibly moved on these issues. And that was often driven not by journalists necessarily, it was driven by loss of life, of feeling those costs. And so when Americans were dying in our wars, you saw these widespread anti-war movements. You saw it obviously most notably during the Vietnam era, but you also saw it in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan of the aughts. You saw that kind of public demand to end this kind of external intervention across the world where Americans were losing their lives. Now, when you take that out of the picture, and just to give you an example, more Americans have died by suicide in the war against ISIS than have died in hostile deaths, according to the numbers the military puts out. So when you take what has often been the primary factor or one of the primary factors involved in that kind of accountability, you know, you're not necessarily going to see that kind of widespread change. So beyond just the American public, the second sort of change factor that I've seen primarily correlated with transformations were foreign government pushback. So when someone like Hamid Karzai, who did this years ago, really pushed back against civilian casualties from night raids, refused to sign agreements, when these partner governments, people we rely on, have that leverage by saying, look, you cannot keep more troops here unless you agree to X, Y, Z, you saw changes. And right now, in other parts of the world, we do not have foreign actors engaged in that kind of leverage-laden pushback. It does not happen right now. And so, personally, I'm quite skeptical that we're going to see major transformative changes based on past examples of what has occurred. But I am hopeful and I am open to learning more and seeing whether these claims that are being made really do materialize.
Azmat Khan is a reporter for the New York Times. Her work on America's remote warfare in its most recent wars won her a Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. Azmat, thanks for joining us on World Affairs.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for those great questions.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you'd like to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we'd like to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there international stories you'd like us to be covering? Send an email or voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Ryan Housel, Elise Manoukian, Matteo Schimpf, and Andrew Stelzer. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. Research and fact-checking was provided by Ryan Housel and Elise Manoukian. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.